In our last episode of the season, we join our founders as they reflect on the Open Institute's journey over the last 10 years and dream of what is to come. Thank you for joining us.
In my perspective, I think here's the unique thing about OI and milestones. We've set some of these milestones. Some of these milestones, I don't think we achieved them without really setting them in the beginning. Like, we didn't know that it was going to be a milestone. It was just, you know what, we need to do some of this work in the community, and all of a sudden something else would come up and we would hit that milestone. So for example, when we were working with Lynette, you know, we went there to preach to them about what you need to do with data, and all of a sudden we realized that it was the community knew what they wanted, and so it was more of them teaching us, right, you know, lessons.
Yeah.
And so I think in that way, when you look at achieving milestones sooner, some of these milestones were not even, first of all, created by us. They were created by the community.
Yeah, they were created by the people we were working with. Because so the thing about OI is the fact that we don't overplan. We know something needs to be done, so we do it. And majority of the things that we have gotten done, conceptually speaking, if you are thinking about them before, mm-hmm, if you're planning them in advance, they looked impossible. If before we had done work with Lynette and gone and collected data from 12,500 households, anyone had said that with less than $20,000 you could do this. Of course it's impossible. If we were trying to plan it, we would have been thinking about that we need you know, planning time and conferences and things like that. We need researchers to agree on the questions and so on and so forth. And then we would, but when we went there and we sat with the community and they already have the spirit to let's do it, let's see how that goes. And we're not paying the community. We still don't pay communities per diem and all these things. Apart from food, we don't pay per diems. But then what we did is that we went there and the community was ready. And we didn't even think at the time, because we had just met with all the leaders of the statistics organizations of the continent, and they had told us that what we were planning to do was impossible. So when we went to do it, we didn't think that it, mm-hmm, it could be done. I've never forgotten that they said, "You foolish children." but then what we were able to do is that we were able to achieve it in a very short time. And that became the most groundbreaking thing for citizen-generated data. And it was, again, a first in the world. So we have a series of things that we have done that turned out to be a first in the world, but it was just because of the fact that...
So it wasn't necessarily a milestone that we had set. Right?
Yeah.
It just came out from the activities that we're doing. And I think that the other thing is that with some of the project-based funding that we get, those ones have goals.
Yes.
Right? I don't think there's any project-based funding project that we have not hit our goals earlier than was
all of them, or at least done more.
And
I think it started out with that thing started out with the first ever funding that we got from Robert Hunja at the World Bank of $10,000. And we had so much to prove that we did, I think, $40,000 worth of work for $10,000, and partly because of the fact that it didn't actually cost us extra to do it. It required us to spend energy and time, and we were able to pull it off in record time. In fact, we were able to do it earlier than he had planned. Yeah. So then we were given more work.
That ethos has been part of the organization from the beginning.
From the beginning, yeah.
What are some of the sacrifices that you've had to make?
Sacrifices that we have made, I think you have to categorize them, because they're personal sacrifices, they're financial sacrifices, even mental sacrifices.
So I think at a personal level is sleep, is time with family and also fights with family because of the fact that we are taking money out of the family to go and do this
thing. Not bringing any in.
And what is interesting is that nobody can actually see why. You know, you're the ones who can see. You've got the idea. So you're the one with the idea. And your families are looking at you like, well, look, we have college funds to think about and all these things. So what are you doing? Taking our money to go and do this thing that looks like charity or that looks like... And then it's not a straightforward charity because, you know, if we were building roads or we were building
something
schools,
something tangible,
people would understand. This is something so up in the air that was difficult to understand. So there's that aspect. I remember having to be called in front of my mother and my grandmother to be told, you know, listen, you need to organize your priorities, you know, because, you know, guys. So there was that. So there was that personal sacrifice. There's a financial sacrifice, of course. Mm-hmm. The fact that we were in debt for a long, long, long time. Long time. And that weighs on you. There's a health sacrifice.
Oh, yeah.
Because of the fact all the traveling you have to do, all the hard work you have to do, the long nights, the early mornings, and all these things, all of those, when you put all those together.
Yeah, in fact,
I mean, it takes a toll.
In fact, you know, for me, the health was a big one. I mean, I still have the scars from all the work that we did. And there was somebody at the World Bank who at one conference, when he looked at me and he was like, okay, if you're gone, you're not going to be good to anybody.
Right.
And that was like at the height of when we were doing just so much stuff. And there was also a lot of stress.
Yes.
And he gave me some advice. And I think that's the kind of advice I would preach to everybody. And I've never forgotten it. And he said, you know what? In life, you juggle many balls,
yes,
right? And some of them are glass balls and some of them are rubber balls. And he says, you know, your work, money, those kind of things, those are your rubber balls, right? If you drop them, they'll bounce back, they'll bounce down and they'll come back up.
Yeah.
He says your glass balls are your health and your family. And if you drop those, that's it, it's shattered.
Yes.
So he says, you need to start taking care of yourself. And I think from then on, I mean, we still worked hard, you know, my perception of working also changed.
Yeah. I think if I was going to do a TED talk, even now, forgetting 2030, I think if I was going to do a TED talk now about starting an organization, or if I was going to speak to somebody who was starting an organization and tell them, number one, there's a debate that I've been having with some young people lately. Interestingly, with a lot of young people in different spaces. I would say that you can't run away from the working hard. You can't run away from the going deep into the mission. I don't think you can run away from it. You have to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, we would not have grown as fast and as far as we have if we hadn't put in the actual work and pushed ourselves very, very hard. So that's an important aspect. But we wouldn't take the if I was thinking about the kind of thing that I wouldn't do again, is that I wouldn't risk, as you say, family, the glass walls as much as we did. I mean, us taking money and doing this was because of the fact that we believed in the mission. But at the same time, you know, two opposites can be true at the same time. At the same time, if you believe in a mission hard enough, in my view, you have to put all your blood, sweat, and tears into making it work, because otherwise, at the end of your life, you will always ask yourself, think about it, if we had slackened a little bit just quit. Today we would be looking at the things that we've been able to achieve in Nanette and all these places. We would be looking at the government offices that now are transparent.
Yeah, and the fact that we actually reached a place where donors are actually coming to us.
Right.
Then we're going out there to...
Exactly. So if you look at all of these things and you look at the fact that in the mission we actually achieved quite a bit. We've got hundreds of thousands of people that can access their governments better because of the work that we have done. We've got, you know, whole counties that can now access... If we... Quit.
Spotlights on, like you said, you know, spotlights on the invisible communities that even the government doesn't know exist.
Does not know exist. If we quit, then we don't change these lives. We don't impact these lives. And you see, the thing about OI, sometimes when people are thinking about it from a from a, you know, box perspective, we are not education, we are not livelihoods, we are not health, and so on and so forth. But we are very much in those sectors because of the fact that we think about the system, how the system can change overall. And that's it can be a hard thing to understand, but that's where we put our blood, sweat, and tears. I always remember this thing that I was told by one of my mentors, who said, listen, the world has many problems. You have to pick one problem and take as big a bite out of that problem as you can. And if you succeed, then you'll realize that you've actually changed the world, and you've opened up the path for many other people to change the world in that way, to continue taking bites at that problem. Our biggest bite was to make sure that the world is transparent. And I love that we are just getting it done. Yeah. Just getting started, though, but we're getting it done.
I think the other thing, other than the hard work and you know, family and sacrifices, I think one of the things that I would tell people about organizations, starting organizations, is be careful of who you trust.
Yes.
Because the trust issue, when we were young, it was like, when we were young in the organization, we were never young as from a physical perspective.
Yeah.
But when we were young in the organization, just because desperation set in, you try and agree to every single thing.
Yes.
You try and get, you know, even if just because you wanted that, even that minimal funding,
yes,
just to sort of keep going. And I think that you need to be in a position where you take a step back and say, is this really going to be beneficial for the organization, for me? And to begin very early on to create a group of trusted advisors so that you just don't jump in head first. That if there is something, even if it's all transparent and clear and you know what you think you need to do, there's always somebody that you're able to go back to and say, can you look at this? Do you think it's the right thing to do? Somebody who can advise you.
Yeah.
And I think that was something that we were missing at the time. There was nobody that we
could no one we could run to. Yeah.
So I think the trust issue is also a big one.
You know, one thing, you should talk about the money. So the thing
which
that
one?
The thing that Jay does, you know, you spend time nitpicking about pennies. You spend a lot of time nitpicking about every single cent and looking at that Excel sheet and just seeing that we've just spent 50 bob, so now we have 50 bob less, and that will impact us in September in this way, and so on and so forth. I think that's part of the magic that got us to where we are. You should talk about what your process is. What's that process?
Oh my goodness me! I think that again, that's so. I mean, I have a finance background, right? And that background was not out of choice.
Yeah.
Right, and I spent more time in tech than I did with finance, but for some, you know, crazy reason, it came, you know, full circle, and now while I'm still involved in tech and the programs as well, you know, finance is the big thing. So one of the things that I realized very, you know, early on when we actually started receiving funding is, and because I was also in the startup culture, you would see, for example, startups would either receive funding or they would get prize money for hackathons, and all of a sudden, you know, the Mercedes was there, and you know, they would just spend the money without having any processes in place, and before you know it, the organization's shut.
Mm.
Right? I didn't want that to happen with us, obviously, and obviously going through the last 4, 5, 6 years of not having any funding, once that money came, it was like, how can I take a dollar and use that $1 to do 5 things instead of one, right? And so we started putting in place processes that would allow us to at least forecast 2-3 years down the road, right? And then that would allow me to communicate to the organization, to communicate to you, to say, hey, listen, by this time, we're going to have to need this much money if we're going to achieve these goals to get the organization to this place, right? I think the other reason why we put processes in place was also in part because we never wanted to go back where we were.
Yes.
Right? So there's still, even up until today, when we do have you know, funding that allows us to, you know, pay our bills, allows us
keep
to cover our operational costs to do our projects. It's still a struggle, right?
And it's always
still a struggle, but there's still something at the back of the mind that says we have to be very careful about how we spend our money.
And we have to get used to you saying no.
Yes, exactly. You know, and then, you know, there's the added pressure that the staff puts in, you know. Al keeps on saying he needs his private plane, and, you know, I have to...
Look, guys, let's explain what this plane is about. A person who is working as hard as I do needs a basic mode of transportation.
Yeah, I agree.
From point A to point B. And surely it is not too much to ask for me to get a small plane so that I can be able to go to more counties and to do more things. Surely it's something basic that a person of my caliber
And you know what? We spoke about milestones.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll start off with a small plane for you from the toy shop.
Yeah.
And, you know... Use that as a milestone. Wake up every morning, look at it, and, you know, eventually...
I have a private plane in my Pinterest, by the way.
Yeah, and eventually, 30, 40 years from now, we'll get there.
Wow, 30, 40 years. Yeah. Hopefully sooner.
Yeah.
We've achieved milestones sooner, so hopefully
that's soon. That. So you keep your milestones at 30, you'll achieve it at 20.
Yeah, okay.
What would you like to achieve in the next 20 years?
The one thing for me is to see that the organization has grown to such an extent that we have put a spotlight on as many people at a subnational and community level as possible, and through our work have managed to in some way bring these people out of poverty. I think that would be a huge milestone.
You know, if this organization, it's a number of things actually for me.
Yeah, it's a 1B, 1A, and so on.
My 1A is that if I could prove that we have, you know, with the Kenya Open Data Initiative, the Kenya Open Data Initiative, if looked at in a linear fashion, it didn't succeed because of the fact that it went on for a couple of years and then it flopped. But if you step a little bit back and look at the whole picture, you then realize the Central Bank of Kenya is not transparent by default. The IEBC is not transparent by default. The Treasury publishes data by default, like on a regular basis. KNBS is publishing data by default. So the work that we did with Kenya Open Data paid off in the sense that it created the mental model for people that it is actually possible to publish data. If we succeed in getting all 48 counties in Kenya to have a data desk, to have to publish data on a regular basis, and to develop new systems for citizen engagement, if I see that counties, instead of, yes, they put out an ad in the newspaper as they would, but if I see that counties are actually putting out, sending out pro boxes with a little speaker on top, telling people there's going to be a public participation meeting, come one, come all.
Yeah.
And I see that we have public participation meetings in every ward that have hundreds of people. For me, that's huge
success. And not just having those meetings, but actually listening to what the people are saying and implementing what's
exactly. Up. So that's like a big thing for me. That there's a culture change. And the good thing is that I can see signals of that happening. I've seen signals of the governor of Nairobi, Sakaja, you know, going out onto the ground during their public participation of some of their projects and actually spending time with people on the ground listening.
Mm-hmm.
That's a powerful thing to see. I can see it happening in Nandi, for example. I can see the deputy governor spending a lot of time with women on the ground and sort of listening to what it is and having that inform the direction that they're going. And these are places that we're doing data desk, but to see that is actually having an impact and to eventually see that is having an impact in all 47, that's a really powerful thing. For me to see communities around Africa using citizen-generated data to make a change in their lives, that's a massive thing. But there's one thing. There's my one big thing. My one big thing is that we change the ethos of philanthropy or the ethos of development such that the donors will give money to organizations like us, like, you know, the large international NGOs and so on. They'll give money to them. But what this money is for is not for the international NGOs to go to villages to do the work, but it is for them to feed and support and strengthen community-based organizations. Because the army that we need for transparency to work is in community-based organizations.
We can't do it ourselves
in hundreds and thousands of villages. In Kenya alone, we have more than 4,000 locations.
Yeah.
If we wanted to do citizen-generated data at every location, that means we'd literally have to go and spend the same amount of time we did with Chief Kariuki in 4,000. But imagine a situation where in each one of those locations is one CBO, because those people are from the community. They go and they work with the community, collect that data and push it out. That would be powerful.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing that in the next 10 years, I really hope that we achieve.